Thank you. I'm most disappointed, and I'm sure many of you are as well, that Brindis isn't actually delivering this talk today, because in fact that was what was going to happen. So I'm in a sense delivering the talk that she was going to give. In late October 2009, we heard through the Icelandic news that a flock of feral sheep who had been in independent residence for over 30 years on Talapni, a mountainous peninsula in Vestfjörður, that's the northwest coast of Iceland, had been herded with great difficulty off the mountain and slaughtered. As the story of their capture unfolded through the media, a fascinating tale of rather messy and unresolved human dominion unfolded. A group of the best herders, known as Smala, of the area, together with their sheepdogs, had risked their lives climbing the mountain Talapni to retrieve this flock of feral sheep for capture. This was done by orders from the chief legislative officer for the area. The consequence was that from a flock of 25 sheep, 15 sheep were captured, or 15 ewes were captured, no, sorry, 15 sheep in total were captured, 5 jumped off the cliffs to avoid capture, and 5 sheep managed to escape. The 15 were loaded on board a boat that had brought the herders to the mountain. There was no accessibility by land. It's extremely difficult terrain, as you can imagine from this. And were taken to Patricksfjörður, a small local town, where they were immediately slaughtered. Of the 15 sheep, there were 8 ewes, 4 rams, and 3 yearling rams were captured also from the other side of the mountain. The 5 remaining sheep, which were 2 ewes with lambs, were captured a few months later, in January 2010, thus ending, for the time being at least, the existence of sheep on Talapni. There is a history of the feral sheep being on Talapni. It's thought that the flock initially came from a farm called Lambri, whose farmer, due to age and ill health, was not able to manage his sheep in accordance with the law. In the early 1970s, the farmer stopped farming as a consequence of that, and he left the land to his family. And although they took up residence, they had no interest whatsoever in keeping farm animals. So the sheep seem to have just found their way onto this mountain. In accordance with Icelandic law, landowners of a registered farmland have a duty to contribute to herding sheep generally in their district. In the Vestfjords, this involves negotiating the many steep mountains that characterise this landscape. It's a dangerous task, not only requiring detailed knowledge of the area, but also substantial agility and fitness. So, in respect to the development of this work as an art project, I'm not sure you mentioned that. You did. Yeah, we are artists. sometimes it's easy to forget. Her father was born there. Brindis has a personal connection to the area. Her father was born there, and as a child, she would go to visit relatives who at that time constituted the few remaining families still farming at Saibel in a remote valley called Ingilsfjörður. This area is so remote that in instances of heavy snow, they would all be often closed in and without contact with others for months during the winter months. Her relatives consisted of her grandfather's sister, Elizabeth, and her children, 2 brothers, Gudni and Gudmundur, and their sister, Steinun. Their other sister, Jona, lived in the nearest town, Flattery, about 30 kilometres away, and her children would spend summers at Saibel. And today, one of those daughters, a woman named Elizabeth, or Betty, is the only farmer still living in this area. She has been there farming the land for 30 years. When she was growing up, coming to visit this area was for Brindis like entering into another world. What she remembers particularly, for instance, was that the weather was forecast by listening to the sounds of the birds and the way those sounds reverberated on the mountain on the side of the water. I mention these details here because Ingilsfjörður is a rather similar mountain to this. It's a series of peninsulas, basically, which are very, very rugged, very difficult terrain. And that mountain is called Bavi. But also, during the interviews we conducted, Betty, who is the last remaining farmer in this area, she was cited several times by the people that we interviewed about this herding as being a bad farmer, someone who would neglect to bring in her sheep for the winter. And we later had the opportunity to talk to Betty at length, and it was clear that she had a much more relaxed attitude towards farming than was required by law or was in fact shared by her colleagues. So the first officially recorded and acknowledged presence of the sheep in Tálknaí was in 1984, when there was an outbreak in Iceland of the neurodegenerative disease of scraping. At the time, it was thought that between 40 and 60 sheep were on the mountain already. And an argument ensued between local farmers and the chief veterinary officer about the presence or otherwise of the disease. The farmers wanted proof that the disease was in their area before agreeing to cull their sheep. The veterinary officer could not prove that it was already in the district, pointed to the sheep on Tálknaí as being potentially the kinds of animal that was sort of that were, you know, willy-nilly crossing borders and therefore likely to be causing problems. The chief veterinary officer subsequently ordered the sheep to be culled, and to fulfil the task, he called on a special division called the Viking Squad, which is part of the Icelandic Coastal Guard, to shoot the sheep on the mountain from a helicopter. And you can see why it gets messy. This was something at which the special squad were not expert. To make matters worse, the expedition hit bad weather, and it resulted in having to be aborted. And that left some sheep dead and many others dying. I think up to 30 sheep actually in that condition. In respect of this, they had no choice but to, well, the locals had no choice but to go in and finish what had been started. But they took photographic documentation from the area, and that photographic evidence was used by them in a sense to oppose directives coming from Reykjavik, which is of course where all the major sort of legislation is happening, where things were sent out to various far-flung corners. And there was a resentment about this, okay, about Reykjavik taking control over things that they felt were very much their own sort of matters. In order to research for our project, we visited there in 2010. During the visit, we travelled around interviewing a variety of people involved in the sheep clearance of Tálknaí. We also interviewed others in Reykjavik, some local people now living there, and the current chief veterinary officer, Olafur Dilmundsson, whose specialism is actually in Icelandic sheep. Our team consisted of Brindis and myself, together with Dr. Carl Benediktsson. I know some of you know him. As a professor in geography at University of Iceland, and also an art student researcher called Undur Jonsson. And altogether we interviewed 8 key individuals. Is it 12 minutes here?
Not yet, I'm ready.
I'm probably making this a little bit shorter than that, but I'll give you some details anyway. So the interviews actually rather, you know, predictably, they raised a lot of very conflicting and contradictory sort of issues. Ásgeir Jónsson was the former chief responsible for sheep being herded back off the moorland for the district. His role was important, as for his part, he had for so long turned a blind eye to the sheep being on the mountain. But due to his official capacity, when the court order came, he was forced to take part in the clearance. He also had valuable information in that due to a minor accident at the time, he was placed in the boat before the herding. So he received the animals and was able to sort of feel them as they sort of, you know, touched them and sort of assessed them in that sense, in a very physical sort of way, as each sheep came on board. Oscar Svensson is a sheep farmer who lives and farms with his brother, an elderly father. He has a flock of 800 sheep and is an excellent herder and has excellent sheepdogs. I mean, you know, it is quite life-risking, this kind of this herding that goes on because of the kind of terrain that it is. He was also very knowledgeable about sheep breeding and was proud of the fact that he has the only remaining known descendant, ewe, from Tálknaí. This was the progeny of a sheep that had escaped to Tálknaí, but which he had herded back from the flock. His description of the characteristics of this sheep was interesting, as when he let it free in spring, it always heads to the top of the nearest local mountain and spends the summer up there alone. Thröstur Reynsson took part in the herding as an employee of the town council. As the owner of a good reliable dog. The area we're talking about is is this here. Actually, it's a better map here. So yes, this is Tálknafjörður. Okay. So and then this is the other similar peninsula I've been talking about, where Elizabeth farms. Yeah, he talked about the wariness of the flock and the reasons for it being so, as he thought, because the flock had been used to target practice by locals. some just for fun, and in order for others just to have free meat. Sven Tryggvason was employed by the governor of the local council in charge of the herding. He selected the men who went on this trip. He talks about the different characteristics of the sheep and why dogs did not work as they might in other sheep herding exercises. And he thinks it nothing unusual that the sheep fell from the cliffs. It's characteristic of sheep being cornered on a mountain. And he talks from the perspective of animal welfare, and that the group of sheep would be much bigger had it been kept in the right conditions. So, so all the time we were working or talking to people who had, who were sort of, in a sense, seeing that the sheep had lived in and successfully reared up there independently of human beings for over 30 years. And then others who were very cynical about the thing and in a sense were very much behind the idea that these sheep should be retrieved, and because it just went against all sort of principles. A lot of the principles that were being transgressed, in a sense, were those of what it is to be a good farmer. Okay, so there were issues of pride the idea of care for these charges. I might come back to some details, but thank you. I'll just touch on a couple more then. Lilja Magnusdottir was born and brought up in the farm opposite Tálkni. She was part of the first serious attempt at gathering Tálkni sheep in 1992. So all the way through this, you can see that there have been attempts, in a sense, to retrieve these animals. It's just proved too difficult. And therefore they continue to sort of live independently on that peninsula. She's interested in the breeding of Icelandic sheep and describes the physical appearance of the sheep, both as livestock and as meat, during and after the 92 gathering. Her description concerns the particulars of the shape of feet being higher and thicker than normal sheep, and also about the longer and more slender body. She was also one of the people who talked about the legs appearing to be longer in those sheep. As a consequence, she talked about this. She used the term natural selection, and she was one of the first people that were talking quite openly about the idea that there seemed to have been some kind of evolutionary process having happened over a very short period of time. And then she talked about the importance that actually the kind of sheep that had escaped already had physical characteristics which would actually make them generally fit the climate and the topology or the topography up there more than others. And then I'll just Jon Thorsson was one of the landowners of the land closest to Tálkni. He was against the herding of the sheep and wanted to keep them on the mountain. His ideas were that as such they could have become a tourist attraction, and that at the time of our visit, he was living in the nearby town of Bildudar, and there he ran a tourism and fishing business together with guest houses and art gallery residency and so on. He tried to stop the sheep being herded by declaring them to be on his land, but he would have had to build shelters for them on site to adhere to regulations, therefore his claim was dismissed. Okay, Icelandic sheep. There's a natural sort of stock of Icelandic sheep that have been there since the Vikings, since the Norwegians, in fact, arrived in 874. I'd like to focus a little bit on, in a sense, what we're doing with this material, what we're starting to do, and the thing, the gesture that we actually already have done at this point. Two things first come to mind. The first is that the role of the image has been quite prominent during the episode, and how images help to form the identity of the sheep as a special flock, and is like a flock worthy of special attention, and how at the same time they help to transport them from being living produce destined for consumption into being beings of note, deserving of their right to live out their lives. From the interviews, there are many significant contradictions. There is the unshakable belief in the need for adherence to legislation that's already in place. There's a matter of pride and the desire of the farmers to be seen to take care of the animals in their keeping. And there are the contradictions regarding how that care is seen or can be seen to be manifested. Some years ago, when we were on a residency in during wintertime in Iceland, in Ströma, near Reykjavik, we came across a flock of old Icelandic sheep in the lava landscape of the area. And since we've been working on the Tálknafjörður project, it's now brought us back to this image. It's one of many that we took, and actually some video as well, which is, for Brindis and I, it bears a resemblance to the painting Scapegoat by William Holman Hunt, which I'm sure many of you know. And the work, this work of course concerns blame and the unburdening of sins upon another. It's a counterpoint to the Tolkien story rather than a parallel. But it involves the conscious, willful dismissal of the animal into the wilderness, away from its domesticated state. It's an enforced banishment to perish in a wild place, along with a portion of blame. And when we're working with the Tálknafjörður sheep, we have thought about this in respect of the compelling and attractive nature of the story. It's a very sort of compelling story. And there's a kind of degree of romance in it, obviously. And it's very easy to, in a sense, sensationalise the event and be very critical of the bungling or apparent bungling that went on during that herding episode. But in so doing, obviously, one runs the risk of trivialising and diminishing the farming community in Iceland per se, which perhaps is an overgeneralisation. The embodiment of this animal in this non-human landscape suggests a representation in reverse. And now I'm not talking about the scapegoat anymore, I'm talking about this one. A representation in reverse. The animal in question has grown into its larger self through the process of its adoption of this landscape beyond human accessibility and control. From an early stage in the examination of this story and the research material we've accumulated, we stumbled again and again on the claim that a natural evolutionary process had occurred, and that the Tálknafjörður sheep had developed longer back legs due to the negotiation of this demanding mountainous landscape. The value of the leg pertains to its role in the extruding and extruded process of liberation. The sheep stayed out and over time became better capable of remaining out by a process of evolutionary responses to environment. At least that's, a lot of people hold that idea. The symbolic driver, in representational terms, is in a retrieved relic. Even a faked relic, designed and made in order to give value to something observed, but not allowed to survive, not to be measured and corroborated by instruments of science. The biggest significance is in the exposure of the insecurities of expert culture. Those who felt they should have power felt their power usurped. In managing the evidence, that's actually managing the evidence, that is, disposing of the flock and subsequently the carcasses and the bones, the local community of experts reduced the physical signs by which the history of this event, this nomadic becoming, could be remembered or told. In the absence of relics and data, all fact and fiction are conflated. All borders between them are blurred, and therefore subject potentially to wholesale dismissal as myth. But by ascribing the greatest significance to materiality and ensuring its strategic absence, the perpetrators of this act perhaps underestimated the ripple effect of this removal. Into every void the imagination will pour its will, or at least its questions. Without the hard evidence to provide a satisfactory backstop to such a suspicion, the impertinence of the question is always likely to exceed what facts alone might have tempered or quelled. For this artwork, the bone is extended in correspondence with the lengthening of the legs, as reported by some observers of the sheep. The significant gap is bridged by a hoop of silver. It's a material we accept culturally as being of value. The human representation and symbolic bestowal of significance may even be seen as a compromise here, in deference to the semiotics of a culture that often fails to recognise intrinsic value. Here it gives presence to the missing, valuable, phenomenological and symbolic apparent effect. The change intrinsic to A, a period of time, B, a specific location, C, the embodiment of the nomadic principle of becoming, and in addition, both D, a theft, and C, a possible conspiracy, where all evidence of the flock and its bodily remains was eradicated, before biologists, for instance, had a chance to examine them. Broadly, it is the embodiment of difference in opinions and of the contested claim that the sheep adapted and evolved as a consequence of having become feral. As there was no opportunity for scientific study to be conducted on the flock before or after slaughter, we mark a space in which this extension hovers between memorial and the relational consequence of being feral in a mountainous landscape, keeping alive the story of a community of domestic animals which, despite climatic inclemency and seeming impenetrability of landscape, survived without human care for 3 decades, and indeed demonstrated that they might have continued to live there in perpetuity. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, are you happy to start without any slides? Because that's just going to take a minute. Let's leave these both on there at some point.
I'll be talking to my slides pretty quick. So.
Okay. So, eventually, if you want to turn it off, once that one comes on.
Then do it. I do it.
That's okay.
Then I turn this one off?
Yeah.
Up. Oh, there we go.
Okay. Well, let me do this one then. Sorry. There you go.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to start by thanking Erica. It's been a really fun 2 days, so thank you. So I work on the United States, so I don't have anything as exciting as Nazi cows to talk about today. But I'd like to take you with me about 5,000 or 6,000 miles or something to the west coast of the United States, to the state of California, and to 2 cities in the north of California, San Francisco and Sacramento, which is the state capital. It's like the Three Stooges. That's how an animal advocate referred to the spectacle of the California Fish and Game Commission's 15-year on-and-off deliberations about whether to ban the importation of turtles and frogs for sale as food in Chinese live animal markets in the state. These are 2 species in question, the red-eared slider and the American bullfrog. Pressured on the one side by animal and environmental activists arguing that the ban was necessary to prevent animals from escaping from the markets or being released in Buddhist release ceremonies and harming native species, and on the other side pressured by Chinese community leaders arguing that the importation ban was unnecessary and racially discriminatory, the Fish and Game Commission did what every good commission does. It held hearings and more hearings, on and off for 15 years. In 2010, the Fish and Game finally approved the ban, but the Department of Fish and Game, which the Fish and Game Commission is an advisory body to, declined to pursue the ban. The real action, though, lay not in this somewhat farcical coda of 15 years of struggle, but in the discursive construction and contestation over nature, animals, and race that played out in this site. What I'll argue today is that 2 imaginative tropes were particularly salient in the Fish and Game Commission and Discourses Department's discourse, the wild as resource and the wild as white. So in the first trope, we see the emphasis on the instrumental use of nature or the wild for economic gain, an emphasis on technocratic management through scientific rationality, and the idea of stewardship in the interests of the whole public. And in the second trope, we see the wild conceived of as a pristine sanctuary, unpolluted sanctuary, it being a universal commons that symbolizes the U.S. as a nation, and a place that where you see the transcendence of racial or national claims. Both tropes draw their energy from, and in turn reinforce, the commitments and anxieties of neoliberalism, marked by ceaseless movement of capital and bodies, anxiety about borders and identities, the pervasive commodification and marketization of social relations, and intensified exploitation of animals and the earth in pursuit of corporate profits and consumer comfort. Both suggest that environmentalism in the U.S. today, at least in a few key sites like this on the ground, has lost the battle, given away the store, thrown in the towel, whichever metaphor you prefer. So let me first step back and mention the larger project from which this research emerged. So this project, the talk today is a little bit of an offshoot from the larger book project. in which I examine current controversies over how racialized groups, immigrants, racialized minorities, and Native people use animals in their traditional practices in the U.S. My primary case is the San Francisco Chinatown live animal market case, which started in the mid-1990s and continues today. And I also look at these two comparative cases, Michael Vick and whale hunting by the macaque. I focus on the U.S., but these kinds of animal wars are, of course, going on elsewhere in the U.K. and Europe and elsewhere. So my talk today looks at what happens when San Francisco animal advocates, thwarted by Chinese-American political clout at the local level, turn to the state level, to Sacramento, and to the Fish and Game Commission and Department. The Fish and Game Commission and Department have their own settled discourse about environmental stewardship, which participants in the Commission's monthly meetings usually adapt to and work within. The most salient trope is that of the wild as resource. While this specific language and the instrumental view of nature it conveys predate the advent of neoliberalism, of course, there's little doubt that neoliberalism has led to their revitalization and elaboration. The Fish and Game Commission and Department depict themselves as stewards of natural resources working in the public interest, as value-neutral technocratic managers employing scientific rationality, the best available science, to protect and grow resources. They are about science, they insist, not politics. Objective truth about nature as a whole, not the self-interested pleading of particular groups. Here we are seeing at the state level what De Paiva Duarte observes at the international level about the ascendance of instrumental, what she calls instrumental globality, whose imperative is managing, monitoring, and planning the planet's resources to ensure a continuous supply of materials to meet the demands of industrial production, and the defeat of what she calls ecocentric globality, advanced by deep ecologists, ecofeminists, and others. Much of what the Fish and Game Commission and Department do in California is regulate hunting and fishing in the state. So they determine bag limits, they issue regulations, issue licenses, and collect fees. They're sometimes charged with being in the pocket of the hunting lobby, of caring more about hunters than nature. So they tend to respond in one of two ways. One is to valorize the instrumental use of nature as beneficial and appropriate. So let me show you two slides which use data from the Department of Fish and Game's website. So this is lifted directly from their website. And what's striking here is that they're talking about the economic, positive economic impact of hunting for everybody in the state. So I'm not going to read the whole slide, but I highlighted this one place. If we were to look at hunting as a corporation, hunting would be 35th place on the Fortune 500 list of America's largest businesses, right between JCPenney and UPS. Okay, and then hunter spending is shown to have all of these very positive economic benefits. So hunting is big business where the state sells particular commodities, nature and the wild animal, to the consumer hunter, boosting not only state revenues, but the overall economic health of the region. This, again, set of figures taken directly from the Department of Fish and Game's website, where they're, again, making the case there are direct economic benefits from hunting for everyone in the state. So hunting is good for everyone, we are told, not just the hunters, and the key measure of rightness of action is economic value. The Department of Fish and Game's second response to the charge of being an arm of the hunters' lobby is to continuously deny that there isn't any contradiction between the consumptive instrumental use of nature, on the one hand, and ecological well-being or ecological value. In fact, they assert there is a harmony of interest between these two. In the heyday of environmentalism in the U.S. in the 70s, it was acknowledged in the public sphere that ecological values sometimes conflicted with instrumental or consumptive values, and there was an effort to try to balance those two or weigh them against one another. The Endangered Species Act of 1973, for instance, reflects this kind of recognition. But today, in the new millennium, the California Fish and Game Commission and Department tell us there is actually a harmony between these two kinds of interests. We make use of nature, but we also sustain and protect it, so we all win. The Department of Fish and Game's mission statement is a good example of how EcoSpeak can be used to mask the ascendance of neoliberal imperatives. So this is their mission statement, and I highlighted two passages. The mission of the Department of Fish and Game is to manage California's diverse fish, wildlife, and plant resources for their ecological values and for their use and enjoyment by the public. The department maintains native fish, wildlife, plant species, and natural communities for their intrinsic and ecological value and their benefits to people, okay, et cetera, et cetera. So note that the use of the conjunction and in these two passages, right, suggests a coincidence of interest and denies there might be a deep and abiding conflict between these two sets of values. You see this formulation everywhere in Fish and Game Commission and Department material, this pairing of ecological and economic, which suggests it's playing some kind of important ideological function here. So this is how I think the Fish and Game Commission and Department use ecological language as legitimating cover for what is really the headlong commodification of the wild and all that is in it. They understand they have a constituency, a public constituency, particularly in California, that is growing in environmental consciousness, and their use of this language assuages public anxiety about the instrumentalization of nature. The notion that there is a harmony of interests is a prerequisite for the Fish and Game Commission and Department to depict themselves as stewards, engaged not in politics, but in what they describe as sound, enlightened resource management for the good of the whole. It's in the nature of contradictions, though, that they cannot be perfectly concealed. A poll of the Department of Fish and Game's own employees showed that substantial numbers believe the department caters to commercial interests, hunters and developers, while ignoring science and the protection of nature. In other words, directly challenging the department's own image. This is the department's employees. Here are a few statements that respondents to the poll wrote in their surveys. The state's biota are our primary constituents, or should be our primary constituents, not special interest groups. Public trust responsibilities should override recreation and commodity interests. The insinuation of business and commercial interests in resource management issues. Nor does all of the talk of stewardship and scientific management fully obscure the violence that hunting entails. It's hard not to be stopped short by this language on the Department of Fish and Game's website pertaining to submitting bear skulls for scientific assessment. So if you shoot a bear, kill a bear, you need to turn in the skull to the department. And I found this language, you know, kind of stopped me in my shoes. Important, place a stick or other object in the bear's jaws so the mouth remains open. To save time, please call ahead before bringing your bear skull to the department office. That's, again, all language taken right from their website. In the picture of this picture of a bear hunt in California, the ecstasy on this man's face suggests there's something more going on here than the optimal management of wildlife resources. This picture also reminds us that the elision between species and individual animals, the disappearance of the individual animal in environmental discourse that Marty Keel has warned of, is what makes possible this contradictory claim of protecting animals in order to kill them. It is, in fact, the individual bear, not the resource or the species, who suffers, bleeds, and dies. And it is precisely the individuality of the bear, which is denied in treating bears as fungible constituent elements of the resource fit for harvesting. It's worth noting that animal and environmental advocates who are weighing in on the importation ban followed the Fish and Game Commission's lead in talking about animals as resources. Not one raised the question about the appropriateness of this language or what it might mean for animals to be designated in this way. And then there are moments of rupture when the contradictions long suppressed are suddenly exposed in all of their rawness. One such moment occurred a few months ago when Dan Richards, president of the Fish and Game Commission, posted pictures of himself gleefully hoisting the corpse of a mountain lion he killed in Idaho. The voters of California put an end to mountain lion hunting in the state via Proposition 117 in 1990, but it is legal in Idaho. The Humane Society, 40 members of the California Assembly, and Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom called for Richards' resignation, saying he was not fit for the job of primary public steward of the state's wildlife resources. As this blogger put it, killing a mountain lion is wrong, and someone with his job killing a mountain lion shows he doesn't deserve the position. Defiant, Richards wrote a letter to Assemblyman Ben Hueso, which contained this statement: I will continue to hunt and fish wherever I please, as I have always done, ethically, licensed, and proudly associating with true conservationists who daily fund, protect, enjoy, and enhance our bountiful resources while not trying to limit others' enjoyment of the same. Hunters from all over the state vigorously defended Richards in cyberspace, and dozens showed up at the monthly commission meeting to support him. For just a moment, though, the contradiction that is at the heart of the Fish and Game Commission of the mission of the commission was exposed. An appointed jab at Richards, who used dogs to tree the mountain lion he killed, State Senator Ted Lieu, who is Chinese-American, introduced Senate Bill 1221 to ban the use of hounds in bear and bobcat hunting in California. There's a little bit of bad blood between Richards and Lieu, which I will come back to in a moment. And briefly, the second discursive trait of the wild is white. So Bill Cronin points out in his important essay, The Trouble with Wilderness, that the modern idea of wilderness grows out of specific class and race relations. In the 1600s, the wild in the U.S. was imagined as the dark dwelling place of savage Indians and beasts who had not been favored by the light of civilization. But by the late 1800s, wealthy white businessmen re-envisioned the wild as a pristine sanctuary and theater for their masculine demonstrations of mastery over nature and animal. Indians had to be removed, of course, both literally and imaginatively, for this notion of the wild to work. Here Bruce Braun echoes Cronin on the racing of nature as white. Consistent with a discourse that linked non-whites with degeneracy and associated both with the city, nature was troped as a site of moral and racial purity, the true foundation of the nation. The journey into nature was in part how whiteness was constituted. Conversely, the city became the place of darkening where one risked moral, if not genetic, decline. Nature then served as a purification machine, a place where people became white, where the racial and hereditary habits of immigrants could be overcome. In short, the journey into nature was just as much a journey away from something else, and that something else was race. When the wild is raced as white, those who threaten to pollute it get raced too, specifically as immigrants of color. An early chapter of the book highlights the race-species nexus by looking at the animalization of race, or how race was made with reference to animals and nature in earlier centuries in the U.S. Here, in the discourse about invasive native species, we see animals and nature being made with reference to race and nativity, or the racialization of animals. The invasive native species frame, which has been institutionalized as a way of seeing over the last few decades from state bodies to a national council to international organizations, now dominates the fields of conservation biology and restoration ecology. It's very much a product of a neoliberal age, both substantively and imaginatively. Globalization, in particular global trade, has dramatically increased the intended and unintended introduction of alien species, both plants and critters, as they catch a ride in packing crates on people's shoes or in the ballast water of ships. Also, as Jean and John Komaroff have pointed out, the sometimes hysterical alarm over invasives can be understood as an expression of deep neoliberal anxieties over the unprecedented movement of bodies, the insufficiency of borders, and the challenge of maintaining identity in a maelstrom of change. Lately, some biologists and environmental scientists are actively debating what some have called biological nativism, or bioxenophobia, or the profusion of the invasive native species discourse with anti-immigrant feeling. As these maps indicate, illegal immigrants and zebra mussels are both imagined as a spreading blight, seeping like a bloody stain into the heartland of the nation. Note that in both cases, nativeness is elevated to a high principle, even though the modern wilderness was created precisely through the decimation and displacement of native peoples. Nature, symbolizing the nation, is a common heritage and common property, but it is reserved for whites only. And this is the notion that joins the wild as resource and the wild as white tropes. In the Fish and Game Commission hearings on the importation ban regarding frogs and turtles, the racialization of so-called invasives is more subtle, but no less apparent. Here we have Karen Benzel, who's from In Defense of Animals, which is a major U.S. animal advocacy organization. And this was her presentation to the Fish and Game Commission. So her PowerPoint slide says, non-native, never good. The next slide, who pays? Taxpayers. Native populations fighting non-natives for their survival. And then she says, you have the power to say no more, no more excuses, no further delay. The next slide, you have the evidence, you have the responsibility, you have the power. Laws are being broken, your own regulations ignored. And then she speaks, non-natives are not good. They are usually ecological disasters in almost every case. Someone is going to make money like the pet trade, but it won't be you. You will end up cleaning up the mess, wasting time and resources that should have been spent protecting California's wildlife, not bringing more in. Make the decision, make it now. Make non-natives illegal. So even though she doesn't mention race explicitly, This presentation evokes the pervasive characterization of undocumented Mexicans in the U.S. They are predatory, they are overly fertile, they are destructive, they undercut natives, they take away what is rightfully ours, they damage the economy, they cost taxpayers, they threaten the nation and our way of life. And it's not always just Mexicans. Sometimes invasive aliens are raced as the yellow peril or Islamic terrorists. So here on the first, there's a lot of interesting hype around Asian carp showing up in the Great Lakes in the Midwest. This is just a typical quote. There are illegal immigrants on the loose in the Midwest. Originally hailing from Asia, they're known to resist capture. Once they establish residency, they can eat you out of house and home. So they're talking about the carp, but as an Asian being. And then down here, bioterrorist acts are relatively unpredictable, rare, and thus far small-scale events. In contrast, biological invasions are occurring daily in the United States and have significant impacts. Yet they receive far less attention and fewer resources. Scientists and the U.S. government must work together to implement a comprehensive approach to biosecurity that addresses not only bioterrorism, but also the more common incursions of invasive alien species. So this helps us to understand why President George W. Bush merged part of the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, responsible for handling invasive species, into the new Department of Homeland Security, which also includes ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So in closing, let me return to the bad blood between Dan Richards, the embattled Fish and Game Commission president, and Chinese American State Senator Ted Lieu. 2 years before Lieu introduced the bill banning the use of hounds in bear and bobcat hunting, when Lieu was an assemblyman and not yet a senator, the two squared off in a May 20th, 2010 Fish and Game Commission hearing on the ban, talking about the ban on importing frogs and turtles. So this exchange brings together the two tropes that I've laid out. So briefly, Lieu says, "I believe the ban has a disparate impact against the practices of a racial minority, particularly Chinese Americans. The decision is discriminatory." Okay, on and on. Richards, "Just for the record, I want to make sure we're perfectly clear. I find this that to be one of the most preposterous assertions I've ever heard in my life, that this is discriminatory. We have a major problem here. Lieu, you cannot show the Chinese merchants have caused the problem. Richard, you're welcome to have your opinion. Lieu, it's singling out Chinese Americans. Richard, oh Jesus, I must tell you, Assemblyman Liu's comments on discrimination infuriated me, because that is exactly the politics that enter into these decisions that should never enter into it. It's got nothing to do with discrimination, and he knows that. I find that offensive to this commission who worked so hard to make the right decision. But anyway, I see no need to change what we've already done, and candidly, it just puts on our radar screen that we need to now expand it and continue our, and I'm going to call it a war, for lack of a better word, on the invasive species that are decimating our native wildlife." So this exchange, again, I think brings together the two tropes I've been talking about. Richards implies that scientific management principles and wise stewardship warrant the importation ban on turtles and frogs, that he is thinking of the good of the whole. He reads Lieu's introduction of the race issue as special pleading, as inappropriately injecting politics or particular interests into the proceedings. Lieu, on the other hand, sees Richard's universalist posture as a cover for advancing particular interests of his own, that is, white interests. There are echoes here of the tensions that mark international negotiations on climate change, where China and India, among others, view environmentalism as a new vehicle for U.S. imperialism. So, these complementary neoliberal imaginings of the wild as resource and as white suggest that in some key sites on the ground like this one, U.S. environmental discourse may no longer be the language of challenge and change. Bodies like the Fish and Game Commission set discursive parameters, and animal environmental activists typically accept them because they want to be in the game, and they have specific policy goals that would be undermined if they were to challenge the very terms under which the body grasps the issue. But something is lost when environmental and animal activists talk about wild animals as resources. The radical potential of environmental discourse to unsettle, subvert, and overturn the instrumentalization of nature has not yet been realized. So how might we reimagine the wild? And I just close with a few questions. How might we bring ecological imperatives back in, not as legitimating cover for, but as part of a challenge to neoliberal imperatives? How might we move beyond seeing wild animals as fungible items and symbols of ecological loss and move toward respecting their importance as individuals? How might we move beyond the tendency of some environmental discourse to obscure racial, national power differentials behind the rhetoric of one-worldism? How might we approach the dilemma of living in nature and shaping nature as we unavoidably do, while also respecting it as a source and object of non-instrumental value? And finally, how might we usher in the profound cultural shift Val Plumwood says is necessary to avert ecological catastrophe, a shift away from seeking mastery and toward recognizing our interdependence with other entities in nature? Thank you.